Sind ihr bereit? Are you ready? At least some of you. That's great. So, are you ready as well, Paki? Great. Gut. Hallo, guten Abend. Ich bin Daniel von der Digitalen Gesellschaft und es freut mich, dass ihr zahlreich aus der Winterpause zurückgekommen seid für eine neue Ausgabe des Netzpolitischen Abends. Es geht heute um Spyware, Pegasus und die NSO Group. Das Format hat ein bisschen geändert für heute, aber nur ein kleines bisschen. Grundsätzlich bleibt es dabei. Wir haben eine Stunde jetzt miteinander hier, die auch auf Video aufgezeichnet und gestreamt wird für Leute, die heute nicht herkommen konnten. Danach öffnet die Bar wieder und wir können hier weiter diskutieren. Da möchte ich noch auch heute wieder kurz unseren Partner für den Abend danken. Das ist selbstverständlich das Debattierhaus hier, Karl der Große, wo wir sind. Danke, dass ihr uns den Raum zur Verfügung stellt. Die WOTS, Leute, die hier sind, dürfen gerne ein Exemplar mitnehmen. Unterstützen uns freundlicherweise, indem dass sie jeweils ein Inserat mit der Ankündigung des heutigen Abends publiziert. Und dann bedanken wir uns recht herzlich beim VOG, das die Streaming-Server zur Verfügung stellt, so damit auch Leute zu Hause schauen oder es später nachschauen können. Gut, kommen wir zu unserem Gast. Das ist Donaka. Ah, I forgot it already. So, wir haben vorher echt geübt, denn das haben wir geübt, sonst nichts, aber das haben wir geübt. So, do you want to say your name?
Hi, Donaka O'Carroll. It's a very difficult Irish name. So, no worries.
All right. So, that's also the point where I switch language. We announced it's going to be in German, in English. So, even I felt in the discussion with him before that his German might be better than my English, but we will manage. So, he's a security researcher and works at Amnesty International Security Lab, and he had large influence, to say so, at the project Pegasus. So what the project Pegasus is or was, there is a nice movie, so we're going to show you this movie, so it makes his and my life easier instead of giving a life introduction. So it's a 10-minute movie, and afterwards we're going to discuss about everything which was not in the movie, and of course, you're also free to ask questions.
I will never forget the moment that I not just saw the data, but understood.
So for those who need the subtitle, so.
It was. Once it owns your phone, it owns everything.
It can access the camera, the microphone.
Your videos, your photographs.
It can see what you're writing.
The GPS location.
Your emails.
It can do everything that the user can do and more.
In July 2021, an international consortium of over 80 journalists from 17 news organizations broke the story of a spyware scandal that continues to reverberate around the world. At the center of the scandal was a leaked list of 50,000 phone numbers. Reaching into every corner of civil society, the investigation revealed that the list included activists, journalists, lawyers, and political leaders who had been unlawfully targeted by potential client governments of cyber surveillance company NSO Group. This is the story of how Amnesty International's Security Lab played a crucial role in exposing the forensic evidence that proved beyond doubt that the data could be connected to cyber attacks from the military-grade spyware system known as Pegasus.
What our team focuses on is investigating targeted attacks and targeted surveillance against human rights defenders, civil society, and journalists around the world.
The security lab began investigating NSO Group in 2018 when Pegasus was discovered to have been used to target an Amnesty International staff member.
Now, if they can target one of the biggest human rights organizations in the world without accountability, just think what they think they can do to other human rights defenders. And to me, it infuriated me.
As a result of this attack, the security lab had the clues they needed to discover more about NSO Group and its customers.
They managed to identify approximately 600 domain names that NSO Group's customers were using to deliver these kinds of attacks. We also found a handful of other activists who had also received similar links at the same time. On one of these individuals' devices, we found traces of a new kind of attack.
It used to be that for Pegasus to get infected on your phone, you would need to click on a link, you know, something related to your work. Here, you're really going to enjoy this. It was very manipulative. And then we saw an escalation to what's called the zero click.
Zero click meant that Pegasus was able to install itself on a target's phone without any interaction from the user, making this spyware even more dangerous and harder to detect.
You know, there's like some smart technologists on the other side working for NSO who spend a lot of time and effort trying to create these spyware tools, try to operate them in a way that isn't detectable. And so it's definitely an interesting mental battle to try and understand what they're doing, understand what kind of mistakes they might have made.
Between 2018 and 2020, the number of Pegasus victims identified by Amnesty International, the University of Toronto Citizen Lab, and other partner organizations was continuing to grow.
Even if you haven't been totally owned and there's no proof of infection, the fact that you've even been targeted can have a major psychological impact.
They knew everything I said, they knew that it was really in danger.
They are threats. Of course, you have fear.
On te met devant les gens et on te déshabille. C'est une violence. C'est une violence.
Despite this growing body of evidence and the damage being inflicted on human rights defenders, the response to concerns about NSO's activities had been limited.
We had been talking about this issue alongside many other civil society partners for a really long time, and we had essentially driven home the point that this is an industry and this is a company that by way of transparency, it provides very little information. And so that adds to the atmosphere of impunity.
But with the list of 50,000 phone numbers, this was about to change. Investigative journalists, Forbidden Stories, were the lead organization on an investigation that included The Guardian, Le Monde, and The Washington Post, with Amnesty International as the technical partner.
We've put so much effort into building the expertise to be able to do this kind of research. And if it had not been for those sort of years of work and years of trying to understand how we can do human rights work a little bit differently in this sphere, we wouldn't have been as fit for purpose as we were.
So what was the reaction at the security lab when they first saw the data?
Who were those phone numbers? Who did they belong to? What did this mean? I mean, the questions that just started rolling through my head were epic. But every time we got even like a little bit of an answer about what we were looking at, that feeling of like, this is important. This is really important. It just grew and grew and grew.
It really drove home the fact that this industry is out of control and that we need to rein it in because it has massive implications for human rights worldwide.
Once the investigations into the list of phone numbers were underway, it was essential to step up security measures.
Not only are you working on a very sensitive human rights project, you're working on a sensitive human rights project that concerns one of the largest spyware vendors in the world.
The more we realized what we were looking at, the more we realized that states wouldn't want this information to get out, that NSO Group certainly wouldn't want this information to get out.
For all of our meetings, we were making sure that we didn't have our regular mobile phones or our regular laptops in the same room.
Then through the course of our investigation, we actually found out that a couple of the journalists that we were working with had in fact been targeted.
As the investigation continued, journalists undertook the painstaking task of identifying who the phone numbers belonged to. But how many of these people had actually been attacked by Pegasus? Based on their groundbreaking work, the security lab had the tools to provide the answer.
We developed some forensic tools for extracting data from an iPhone. And so over time, we began to identify more and more of these unknown suspicious process names. And we were able to tie these process names back to the Pegasus spyware itself.
What that meant is they were actually able to build tools that we could then use to remotely access backups of phones and quickly as possible, do an assessment of whether or not there were traces of Pegasus on that phone.
This was the turning point in the investigation. By July 2021, of the 67 phones that the security lab had been given access to, 37 showed evidence of infiltration by Pegasus. As well as 14 heads of state, the wider investigation revealed that the phone numbers of at least 180 journalists in 20 countries were listed in the data. The Pegasus Project also named the 11 countries identified as potential NSO group clients. And Pegasus was found to have been used to target family members of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi prior to his murder by agents of the Saudi state. The forensic tools developed by the security lab have since been made open source and installed over 70,000 times, allowing users across the globe to add to the growing list of confirmed attacks and shedding new light on the scale of illegal cyber surveillance. So with all of this knowledge and all of the secrecy, what was it like when the Pegasus Project was ready to go public?
Are people going to see how important this is, not just for, you know, civil society and human rights defenders around the world, but for like all of us? This is a major privacy issue. This is something that big tech corporations need to look at, that journalists need to look at, that everybody needs to look at. And is this going to be the moment we hope it is to be able to pivot towards actual change?
With repercussions that continue to reverberate around the world, the revelations of the Pegasus Project have been explosive.
As a result of the investigation, a number of sort of steps have been taken in the right direction. The US government placed NSO Group on its entity list for malicious activity. Investigations are open in Hungary, Belgium, France. The Supreme Court of India has set up a technical committee to look into Pegasus targeting. There's many more, but I'll stop there.
Most recently, thanks to the work of Citizen Lab, Apple has filed a lawsuit against NSO Group to hold it accountable for the surveillance and targeting of Apple users. In the face of these revelations, NSO has continued to maintain its position that it provides authorized governments with technology that helps them combat terror and crime.
I'm thrilled to see that the world did take notice, right? People do realize that this is important.
I feel like this is now crunch time, and hence Amnesty has been calling for a moratorium on the sale, transfer, export, and use of spyware until a proper human rights regulatory regime is put in place.
I think people have like gotten over a little bit of this tech apathy that we see all the time. Like tech is, it's too big, it's too scary. We can't regulate it, like it's out of control. Not true, right? This stuff is built by humans and it can be regulated by humans. There is no difference.
There's much more to be done. Investigations need to be held into providing victims with the right remedy, and perpetrators behind this should be held to account.
So we need to keep exposing this work. We need to keep advocating for regulation, and we need to keep reminding everybody that there is hope. You know, we can change this system. Your rights can be protected. Your phone does not need to be a weapon against your privacy.
All right. So a list of 50,000 phone numbers, so just many digits, is the start of. I don't know, maybe that's a bit too much movie-like, so what I imagine now, so a day person walks into your office and says, here are 50,000 phone numbers. So was it like that, and what went through your mind? I mean, 50,000 numbers, just a bunch of digits, what are you going to do with it? Or did you know that's the thing?
So I think we definitely had mixed emotions, because on one side this is we knew that we got this list, and we was like, this is an incredible opportunity to really show the full scale of the problem, but also we on the other side had so many concerns. We're like, okay, this is a huge list. How do we even begin trying to figure out both if this data is real, if we can actually if it is actually linked to Pegasus, whether we can prove with forensic evidence that people can understand that these hacks really did occur, and then just the logistics of it. Because you can imagine this was in 2020, 2021, during the middle of the COVID pandemic, so we couldn't travel anywhere, we couldn't go physically to go meet somebody to get their device to check their phones. And even if we could, we needed to do all of this in a global collaboration while keeping this whole investigation secret. So you have, as Dana said, as my colleagues here said, we have a global scale of the problem. So we need to try and figure out how do we go and meet people, get this evidence, while keeping the whole investigation secret and not exposing it to NSO Group or any of the government customers who use the spyware that we were investigating them. If we had any leak about this investigation before we were ready to publish, it could have sabotaged and blocked the whole project. So I think this was, just the scale was just phenomenal. But on the other hand, it was just such a relief, because before this we were painstakingly trying to find one case here, one case there.
So finally you had a long list of potential victims that you knew where to search for.
Exactly. So I can go back a little bit to show how it was different from how we were working previously. So we first started working on spyware and surveillance at Amnesty in 2017. So I think most people know Amnesty as a human rights organization doing campaigning, advocacy work. And so I think a lot of people we talk to are a bit surprised that Amnesty has technologists and has people doing kind of deep technical research. But I think at least some people at Amnesty realized was that technology is increasingly part of our lives, and it's also a major human rights risk, because states have realized they can use technology and technological tools to try and control and intimidate human rights defenders and journalists and activists, and to try and challenge this technological human rights abuses, we need to have technologists at Amnesty who can really research and document this. We first started working on Pegasus in 2018, when one of our own Amnesty colleagues was themselves targeted, and so it kind of fell into our lap, as you say. This person was working on issues related to Saudi Arabia, and one day they got a message on WhatsApp saying, "Hi, I'm an activist from Saudi Arabia. We're organizing a protest outside the Saudi embassy in DC. Please click this link for more information and help promote our cause." Fortunately, this activist was quite cautious, maybe paranoid, and she shared this link with us instead of clicking on it. And when we got this link, we started kind of digging into it, and that was maybe our first lead to start getting into this whole topic, and especially on NSO.
So you were already about 2 years on the Pegasus thing, to say so, when the list showed up. Yeah.
Exactly. So when we first started working on NSO, we published a report about our Amnesty colleague being targeted, and we kind of published detailed technical evidence showing how it was linked to NSO. But we knew that that wasn't enough, so we kind of continued our work. We continued trying to track this company and trying to find more evidence of these abuses. So the next time we found a case of this was in Morocco. And so we had suspicions that Morocco was using Pegasus spyware to target human rights defenders. We know they'd used spyware in the past. And so we kind of did a more painstaking approach. We looked at the situation in Morocco. We're like, okay, who are the 10 most targeted activists or targeted journalists who are being most harassed by the state, maybe who are being jailed and otherwise intimidated? And so we just started reaching out to people through our Amnesty contacts. We said, okay, you're an activist here. Are you one of you might be under surveillance? And we did some forensics. We checked their devices, and from this, we were able to find some of the first cases of Pegasus surveillance with this forensic proof. And what was really disappointing, though, at the time was we found this evidence, and we published it, and unfortunately, basically, nobody cared. We tried to talk to media, trying to say this is a problem that's happening. No media was really interested in covering it. They were like, this is a too technical issue, or it affects people in Morocco or Azerbaijan, who is not an interesting story for them. And so I think we were at this time really, really frustrated, because we started to realize how big of a problem this was becoming, and that so many more countries could buy these really sophisticated tools. hack any phone, and basically nobody knew about it. And even when we tried to find some proof of it, it still was being kind of ignored or disregarded.
So, from that perspective, once you had the 50,000 phone number list, things became big. So are you happy with the response you got, or would you have expected or hope even for more?
No, I definitely think it's really the response we've seen and the impact it's had has been far greater than we could have imagined. I think what we've learned since about the scale of the problem has also really shocked us, and also we're starting to see some movement to have proper regulation about the software. So I think when we first started working on Pegasus, I think when we started seeing who were being targeted here, we knew it was probably going to be journalists and activists, the type of people we work with. But I think none of us really expected, when we started getting to the list, just the scale of the targeting. So seeing 50,000 people, and when we started looking at the list, it wasn't just a few journalists, it was hundreds of journalists. We see opposition politicians being targeted in Hungary, in Poland. We see some really heartbreaking stories, like the case of Khadija Ismailova, who's an Azerbaijani journalist who's been working for years to expose corruption under the Aliyev regime in Azerbaijan. And so it wasn't the first time that she'd been put under surveillance. We've seen previously that states like Azerbaijan has been using kind of more low-tech tactics. In 2012, she was working on a corruption investigation into the Aliyev regime, and at the time, she one day got an envelope in the mail with intimate photos of her with her partner, and they basically threatened her with these surveillance photos they had of her from her hidden camera in her apartment, saying, if you don't stop your investigations, we'll expose these. Fortunately for her, she's a very brave journalist. She held a press conference and told what kind of intimidation the state was trying to do, and kind of preempted this, and they still tried to leak her sensitive photos to try and intimidate her. And so when we look at, this is just one tactic that a state like Azerbaijan has used, and what we're seeing increasingly is this is happening more and more around the world. So people are using these kinds of surveillance tools, not just to collect information, but also as tools to try and get ways of blackmailing people, of intimidating people. They use information that's stolen from people's phones to leak information to pro-state media that tries to defame people and damage the reputation, and also to organize trumped up charges against people to try and really discredit their work and activism. So you really see it's not just a privacy issue, but it's a massive issue on freedom of expression, and it creates such a chilling effect that people cannot organize freely and communicate with each other.
Well, potentially everyone can be a victim, so we all don't know, except we are running your software. But yeah, we don't know what's on our phone. So as far as I understand, so Pegasus doesn't leave any traces for ordinary people on their phones. So it's hidden, right? Or is there any chance for a person like everyone here, including me, some of us are potentially nerds somewhere, less would we realize if we have Pegasus on our phones?
So I think the really scary thing about Pegasus is that it is very, very difficult to find the traces and to notice it. I think when most people think about hacking or government hacking, they might imagine somebody sending you a phishing email, trying to get your passwords, or maybe sending you an executable file and trying to get you to open this. And this is something we've seen in the past from governments who've kind of developed this software themselves. What's really scary about Pegasus is that they're obviously a very sophisticated company. They have millions and millions per year that they can spend on research and development to buy some of the most sophisticated exploits and ways of breaking into basically any iPhone, any Android phone in the world. We've also what's more scary recently is we've seen them changing their tactics. Before we used to see them doing what's called a one-click attack, and so one-click attack is where like what happened with my Amnesty colleague
Link.
Then you need to click the link. Yes.
Exactly. They send you a link, and you click the link. It's still very easy. It's still very effective because it's not like you need to install anything. You just click the link, and just by opening that link, they'll start running some sophisticated browser exploit in your phone. They can get access to the browser and eventually burrow deeply in the phone. And once the spyware is there, it can basically access anything the user can do, and even more. It can read your signal messages. It can turn on your microphone. It can turn on your camera. It can copy everything it possibly wants from your phone. And unfortunately, it's nothing you see on the phone that will let you know this is happening. It won't necessarily have your battery draining. It won't make your phone slow. It'll just really silently be able to remove this data. And so that's what we saw up until 2018 or 19. So we're seeing these kind of one-click attacks. In some ways, they were hard to detect, but there was still a chance. Because like with our colleague, somebody would see this link, and especially if they know they're being maybe under surveillance or otherwise being threatened, there is some chance that they will notice this and come to somebody like a research team like us at Amnesty or other partner organizations, and we can dig into this. I think what really drastically changed our understanding of the problem is when we realized that NSO was also doing what's called a zero-click attack. So with a zero-click attack, they have developed a complex way of breaking into a phone without the user having to do anything at all. So without having to click a link, without something else, just silently, you can be in bed at night, and just by sending messages to your phone, they can break into the phone and get access to your data. We've seen them doing this in multiple different ways. The first time we discovered this was in 2019, where WhatsApp found that NSO Group had developed an exploit against WhatsApp. And in just a two-week period, this was used to target 1,400 phones around the world completely silently. And we only discovered this when WhatsApp found the exploit and found the attack. And then what was quite helpful in this case was WhatsApp also, a few months later, they began notifying the people that they had discovered who had been impacted by this attack.
And so the people wouldn't know because there would be a WhatsApp message which is, I don't know, not displayed. Or once the Pegasus software is installed, it can manipulate the phone, it can remove its own message. Or, yeah, so that would be really no trace.
Exactly. So in that case, there was no trace visible for the user. They would simply get a missed video call, and just in the initial process of trying to make the video call, they would be able to deliver their spyware into the device itself. So I think what that made us realize is that we as Amnesty and we as people who were trying to tackle this problem, we couldn't kind of wait for people to come to us with suspicions and with worries about links or attachments or this kind of thing. And we realized we had to somehow try to be proactive in going to discover this thing in the wild. And we also needed to start developing some tools and like forensic abilities so that we could check a phone that we suspect maybe is targeted, extract all the data from the phone, and try to find some ways of identifying and tracking this spyware that tries very, very hard not to be identified.
So you said, let me start the other way around. So is there, I don't know, some email or contact you want to publish? So if someone is or has the feeling his or her phone is threatened, or what would you suggest people to do that?
Definitely if you're a journalist or activist and you have reasons to be suspicious that your phone might be targeted, we do have a kind of helpline at our Amnesty Security Lab to help support people in checking their devices. And then also we as Amnesty, we believe that there shouldn't be knowledge that's just kept for a small group of people. But what we've done that's quite different is when we, through the Pegasus Project and our other investigations, we developed this capability to detect spyware that really no one else had done before. We thought it was extremely important to publish this openly so that other people can use these tools and can also check their own devices and help discover other cases that maybe we won't discover ourselves. And actually that's proved very very successful. And since the Pegasus Project was released, we've seen new cases all around the world being discovered using MVT and some of these tools we've developed by partner organizations in El Salvador, in Poland, in Thailand. Now we've seen new cases in Greece where many people in the opposition and journalists have been targeted with another spyware tool.
Another one.
Yeah.
It never stops. So that means also you probably, so the Pegasus case did not, it's maybe less now in media because, well, it was 21 and now other things are happening. So for ordinary people, it's gone. But I assume for you, it's still in that case still ongoing because, well, I think you also released the tool. Maybe you can say something about that as well. But that means NSO Group knows how you know if phones are infected or not. So I would assume that they try to go further and find new ways to cover again. So that means also you would need to update your tools.
Yeah, exactly. It's always like an arms race in this in this situation because we try and identify who's being kind of unlawfully surveilled and targeted with this software. And unfortunately, NSO Group tries to keep making money by selling this to states. And right now, most of their customers who are still customers seem to be, states you can imagine who will abuse it. Like we've seen the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, El Salvador. And so we are always trying to trying to make sure that we're still having some ability to detect these cases. We have seen a lot of changes in the situation since the Pegasus Project. Back in 2021, we were doing these forensic investigations with basically no leads. So we had the Pegasus data. But one thing that's been a real help to our research and also to other civil society researchers is that in 2021, after the Pegasus Project, Apple decided to really try to also tackle this problem. They saw that it's not only bad for their users, but I think it's also bad for their business if their phones are being targeted all the time. And so what they've done is they've also filed a lawsuit against NSO Group in a court in the US, which has been a really promising development. They also have a lot more money to hire good lawyers than Amnesty might do to keep them, to challenge them. But I think besides the lawsuit, what's been super, super powerful and beneficial is they've also started doing notifications. So when they identify that somebody has potentially been targeted with the spyware, they also now send a notification to the target saying, we suspect you might have been targeted by some sophisticated spyware. And that's been super helpful for us, for our investigations, because people are getting these notifications and then they're coming to groups like us, other groups like Citizen Lab, and we can then do the forensic analysis of their device. We can understand, okay, are they being targeted recently? We'll try and find the proof of this, and then we can support them to take different kind of action, either to promote their case. We've also been providing technical evidence to let people take legal actions in their country. And so since then, we've seen in the last year or two, more and more cases coming forward in Mexico, in El Salvador, in Kazakhstan, where people are getting these notifications and then can actually try to seek accountability for the harms that they're experiencing basically in secret without their knowledge.
So you are mentioning the law case started by Apple. Do you know if something moved already, and do you know what? So I heard that they did it, but I lost trace if already some judgment were made or not. Do you know?
So with the Apple case, it's still progressing quite slowly. As I mentioned earlier, NSO also targeted WhatsApp users, and there was another lawsuit filed in the US by WhatsApp back in 2019. So that's been also progressing very slowly. NSO has used lots of legal arguments to try and appeal to say that this action should not be taken against them. They've even taken it to the US Supreme Court to try and say that they have sovereign immunity, that they can't be sued because they work for governments and the governments are not suable in a US court. And so this is quite a far-fetched argument, and thankfully the US government And the US court system has kind of thrown this down, and so now it's going to go back to the regular court to hopefully get to start having disclosure from the company, and we'll start hopefully see some progress around that to try and get some accountability, because unfortunately there's been many lawsuits around the world since the Pegasus project, but unfortunately for many people they're taking legal action against their own government, whether in Hungary, in India, where they control the court system, and there hasn't been there's been far too little accountability and justice for the victims. But I do hope that in some level with this the new Apple and WhatsApp court cases, they can maybe get some disclosure, and if we don't get accountability for the victims, at least we'll get some more information about the practice of the company and how they've been operating and using these tools in a way that's completely incompatible with human rights.
And do you know if something on the level of actual law making changed? So has there been any country who stepped up and said, oh, now we see that this kind of software can also do very harmful, so we are going to forbid it in our country? I mean, most countries say, well, other countries are doing harmful stuff, but not ours, right? Is one country clever or honest enough to say, no, we're not doing that, and we're forbidding that in our territory, or I don't know if what possibilities would be?
So unfortunately...
I guess would be very surprising.
Unfortunately, I don't think we've seen any country that's all now called for a ban on spyware, but we have seen a lot of actually quite promising progress on regulation and legislation in different countries. Probably the first country that actually took meaningful action against NSO was the US government. About 2 years ago, they put NSO on their entity list, which basically bans any US company or person from working or doing business with NSO without a very restrictive license. And while that it's by itself doesn't put the company out of business, I think it shows a very powerful signal to NSO Group and the other spyware companies that it's not a legitimate business. It's not. They like to think of themselves as a tech startup, and they're just building technology tools. But this shows that it's really even the US government is seeing them as illegitimate, and some of the way they've been operating and the countries they've sold it to are really kind of illegitimate. So that's been a promising sign. And then what's been most promising in Europe is the establishment of a committee of inquiry in the European Parliament. This has been going since early last year. It's quite an intensive process where they've been having 30 or 40 MEPs, and they've been really trying to investigate and getting to the bottom of this scandal. So they've invited people from NSO, they've invited many expert speakers. They've also gone now on visits to various countries where in Europe which have abused these tools, including Greece, Poland, Hungary, and now this week they will go to Spain, where Pegasus has been abused very widely against Catalan activists and civil society. I think what's interesting is we see quite an ironic situation in Spain, where Spain has been using tools like Pegasus for many years to target political opposition. But then we saw last year that actually the Spanish government themselves have come out and said that the Spanish prime minister was also hacked with Pegasus. So it's like what goes around comes around, and we're in a very strange scenario with these kinds of tools, where not only are governments using it and then getting hacked by spyware, sometimes the governments are getting hacked by the very same tools they were using. In that case, it was media reports say it was likely Morocco who was trying to spy on the Spanish prime minister. And so there's a whole kinds of geopolitical and other kind of national security risks that unfortunately are probably more convincing to a lot of these states to start putting in better regulation on the sale, use, and transfer of these than when we show evidence that a journalist or an activist is being targeted. And so we have seen, so Amnesty's main policy call is for having a global moratorium on the sale, use, and transfer of spyware and other kinds of surveillance technologies until there's a human rights compliant regulatory framework in place. And so basically, that means we really think this problem has gone too far, that the existing rules in place are not sufficient to stop the harm. And we'd like to all the governments to stop using and exporting these tools until we put better controls on this. To have one good story, I think we have seen that more states and more, at least politicians in the European Union, are supporting this moratorium call. I think really a lot of people are starting to realize why this is needed. We've also seen that the government of Costa Rica has agreed to support the moratorium. So there is at least one country who's supporting signing on.
Well, for the maybe not so much supporting countries, they are usually claim they use it only for the bad guys. So for the terrorists, definitely not for activists, right? And NSO groups is the same, right? We're selling it only to the good states to prevent harm from terrorism and so on. So from an NSO perspective, well, kind of playing their devil's advocate, is it technically possible for them? Or is it like, well, here is the tool, and then whatever the buyer does with it, is it? Or is it like, well, it's more like a service, so please NSO, survey this person. So in the service situation, so NSO would actually have the possibility, not saying they do it, but they would have the possibility to select which people are surveyed and which not, and they could make a claim, so, oh, that's a journalist. So is it possible, or is it just some advertising whitewashing they're doing?
It's a good question, and it seems like NSO can never really get their stories straight. Sometimes they're like, when there's abuse, they say, okay, give us the name of the person or the phone number, we'll investigate this, and if there's abuse, we can check it, and if we find it's true, we'll cut the customer off. And then other times, we say, okay, here's all these abuses that this country's been doing for years, and they're like, oh, we don't know, we couldn't possibly know who the customer is targeting, it's a separate system we don't have access to. And so I think they build a system, they control the system, they know who the customers are, they know they're selling to customers like Saudi Arabia or the UAE, who have a long history of human rights abuses, not just in general, but also specifically with spyware tools, and not just with NSO, but also previously with FinFisher, with Hacking Team, some companies who have gone before this. And we see them just constantly making decisions where they are continuing to sell the products to and provide services to customers who have abused them. I think probably the most heartbreaking case is with Saudi Arabia. Yep. So again, this is we already showed evidence in 2018 where it was being used to target an embassy staff member and another Saudi human rights activist. Instead of cutting off Saudi Arabia from using Pegasus, they continued having them as a customer. And later during the Pegasus project, we found that a partner of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was targeted with Pegasus in the months before his investigation, likely to collect information about him and about his family. And then even just 3 days after the murder, Saudi Arabia targeted his fiance when she was in the most vulnerable time in her life, and they targeted her and prosecutors and everyone around the family trying to cover up their own crimes of murdering this journalist. And even then, NSO did not cut off the customer. So it's like with having these outrageous abuses, and yet they are somehow valuing either the profit over the victims, or else also we see in a lot of cases there is strategic interests in why NSO and Israel allowed a lot of these companies to sell to Morocco or Bahrain or Saudi Arabia, when we see later it leads to normalization and other kinds of intelligence and security sharing at the expense of the victims.
Well, this was anyway something which I found strange, or I'm not sure if Israel as a country is able to control it or not, but I mean, so Israel is not known to have, especially in the Arabic world, every country as a friend. So, how would it be then possible, or that even these countries are using NSO groups' tools? So in the end, Israel doesn't care, or does NSO find a way around that and even may do harm against their own country, to say so, on a higher level? So or sell it to the country's enemy as for the business?
So I think with NSO, at least from all of what we've seen, NSO was not acting rogue as a company. They were very much working with the cooperation and with the support of the Israeli state. NSO spyware is treated like a weapon in Israel, so it requires a license from the Ministry of Defense before it can be exported to any other country. And so as far as we know, what NSO claims at least is that every sale of NSO spyware and every export to any country who is a customer has all been approved by the Ministry of Defense, which supposedly has human rights safeguards in place and will take into account their record and the risk of misuse. In practice, we I think we see from the hundreds and journalists and activists here being targeted that this is not very much not being effective. And so in 2020, Amnesty actually filed a lawsuit in administrative court in Israel to a request that the Israeli Ministry of Defense would revoke NSO's export license, basically because we'd shown that it wasn't sufficient safeguards to prevent the abuses. Unfortunately, after a few months, the court came back and said they sealed the complaint, so all of the evidence was held in secret, which we didn't get access to. And then they said, okay, we've talked to the Ministry of Defense, we've talked to the company, they've assured us that everything is above board, perfectly in order, no violations here, none to see here, move along. then it was quite surprising to see a year later after the Pegasus project, they kind of changed their tune and it came out with their hands up being like, okay, we know mistakes have been made, all these abuses, we didn't know about it, we couldn't possibly have known about it. I think at that point they revoked some of the export licenses, and they limited how many countries that NSO and similar companies could export spyware to without a kind of further approval process. So that was quite helpful, and it was probably also due to the political pressure they were getting from the US and from France, where these states were themselves quite angry and quite worried that now some of their diplomats or own politicians were being targeted with these tools.
All right. If I may, I would get back to a bit of kind of a more personal thing, if I can. So you said, and I mean, it was already clear when the list of 50,000 numbers showed up, and it's even said in the video, so it was kind of clear it became a big thing. In the video, I think it said you did not bring anymore your phone to the meetings. I don't know. The latest at that moment, it sounded also a bit scary to work on such a project. So how was it for you? So was it like, now I'm going every day to work, I'm turning on my computer, I'm playing my games? Or was it at some point and really like, now I need to be very careful and check my phone twice, put it somewhere else, and all that? So did it have some impact on you or on your life? So did you feel still comfortable? Or, yeah, I don't know.
So, yeah, definitely it had a very big impact and stress during the project. So I'm very mindful that I'm living in Berlin. I'm quite privileged and disconnected from a lot of the situations that some of the people we're working with are based in. So I really feel for some of the journalists and activists in Morocco or Azerbaijan who really have a real physical danger. And I personally didn't feel that so much with this project, but I think we definitely had a big sense of responsibility for all of the people who had been targeted with the spyware to be able to make sure that we did this investigation, could show the problem and did it in a way that was safe and didn't put anybody at risk. And so we really put a lot of thought into how we do this securely, conscientiously, without exposing anyone. So in terms of like practical steps, there was a lot of inconvenient technical things we needed to do. I remember at one point having three different phones, three laptops, and we'd have like a regular phone, then we'd have a separate device and a laptop that would be kind of fully compartmentalized. So It would have an anonymous a username, anonymous accounts. And so the idea was, even if somebody figured out about the project and knew we were investigating it and to try to hack our phones or hack our computers, the idea is that they'd never get to understand the full scope of the project because they wouldn't get access to this separate device. I think that was quite fortunate, because in the end we realized that some of the journalists we were working with in India had actually been hacked during the investigation. So it wasn't paranoid thinking, it was people were actively being surveilled. I think it was quite interesting because we also managed to work with some journalists who had themselves been victims of spyware. I think of one particular case of some journalists in Hungary, where when we started looking through the list, we started to try and identify the names, and then we see journalists that actually some of the people in the project recognized and knew had worked with in the past. And so who better to get to investigate spyware than somebody who themselves have been victimized and have a personal interest in doing this. So I remember at the time, again during COVID, one of the journalists from the Süddeutsche Zeitungen flew to Hungary, to Budapest, to meet with this journalist, Szabolcs, and they're like, okay, we need to talk to you. And they had some pretense of that, okay, but you need to leave your phone here. And the journalist was quite, worried what's going on here. And so then when they left the room from his phone, they were like explaining, okay, so we have suspicions that your phone might be under surveillance and spyware, and we have this team at Amnesty who will help check your phone if you give them all the data from your phone. And at first he was also a bit like,
you want to give all your data from your phone? I mean,
so then he eventually he realized it was who we were and what we're trying to do. So he's like, okay, I can share the phone, and we got the data from his device remotely, analyzed it, and then. Quite quickly, within 30 minutes, we could say, okay, on these 10 dates, your phone was being hacked.
Yeah.
And of course, he
knew it's not him and Amnesty who had all the data, it's someone else as well.
Exactly. Yes. And so at that time, he just knew about it. He himself had been hacked. And so with the Pegasus Project, they talked to him, like, okay, so this is must be very shocking as a journalist. It's not just your own personal data that's being exposed. He was thinking back about, okay, who are all the sources I've worked with? Who are the people that might be at risk now from talking to me that now it's been exposed, even though I use Signal, they still got all the data from my phone. But then I think he was quite excited to turn the tables when we said, okay, it's actually not just your phone, but we have a whole list of hundreds of people in Hungary who are being put under surveillance here, and we want you to help dig into it. And he did some amazing work understanding the full scope of the problem and finding many more journalists and activists who are being... targeted by under the Orban government.
So you were never on the list.
As far as I know, I check my phone quite regularly, and fingers crossed I haven't been hacked. But you never quite know.
I don't know. Yeah.
I know. There was lots of my colleague in Berlin lives quite nearby. So usually when we had some sensitive discussion, we'd be like, okay, meet you at the usual coffee shop. We go and then we go for a walk around the block with no phones or computers on us to try and. Playing that, so sometimes old school is the safest way to go.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it worked also in Berlin in the times of the Cold War. Speaking of that, so do you have any tricks or advices you could share? Probably most of us, the audience, is not the main target for Pegasus software. Well, we don't know, but of course we learned, don't click on a link. But is there something else you can do? Or with this zero click, you're kind of, I don't know, machtlos. I would not know the English.
Out of luck.
Yes. Yes, powerless, yeah.
Powerless. Yep. So I think with Pegasus and zero clicks, unfortunately, I don't have good news. Technically, there's very little you can do because they can hack your phone even when it's fully up to date. I think because there's nothing we can do technically to really stop the problem, I think this just shows why we need to do a lot more politically to put in proper regulation on the sale of these tools and the development of these tools. because it shouldn't be up to each individual person to try and protect themselves and have their own counter-espionage agency trying to make themselves safe. It should be up to the political systems and regulation to make sure that this isn't in the hands of people who are going to abuse it. In terms of steps people can take, one positive development has been that Apple actually also added a whole new set of features to an iPhone that's specifically designed for people who are at high risk of being targeted by spyware or other kinds of target attacks. And so it's an opt-in feature on the iPhone. It's called lockdown mode. And if you enable this, you can still use your phone perfectly normally, but it does make some of the common attacks that NSO has used and other companies are using more difficult. So one thing it does is now when you get a link in an SMS, it won't actually allow you to click on the link. So you can't accidentally click in and open it. You have to copy and paste the link if you really need it. And so this is one way to make these kinds of attacks more difficult. They also have a feature to lock down your iMessage so that these zero-click attacks become more difficult. And so it's actually quite impressive that Apple have taken the steps to build this into each iPhone for all of their billion users. And it's already quite helpful because even 2 years ago, this wasn't available. And so we were seeing people who were being hacked today. We would check their phone, find it's being hacked. We even give them a new phone. And then 3 days later, we checked their phone again, and it's been hacked again. Because there's nearly nothing. And we just like felt really powerless. We're just like, OK, I'm sorry, we can't help you. That in some ways, this is like a 65-year-old woman, an activist in France, who's the wife of a Moroccan jailed human rights defender. And yet, here she is in France, being harassed day in, day out by likely Morocco and trying to steal, break into her phone, and there was really nothing she could do about it. It's really heartbreaking to see this case happening.
Maybe as a last question, I have to ask that. So you became now quite a successful hacker, so you're also well known. So there is a YouTube video, I don't know how often it was seen. I mean, companies like NSO are looking for good hackers, so whatever good means in that moment. So did you ever have you ever been approached, or is this in this community the case that people get approached and say, well, maybe come to our side, we might have better salaries or whatever, or is it kind of clear that people working for Amnesty International, they are quite rock solid with their opinions, and it's not worth the time to.
Honestly, I'd be interested to see them try and see what their approach would be. But honestly, I think they would rather, at least NSO would rather see as little of me and the rest of the team as possible. I know NSO at the time. I think they thought they were really incredible. They could never be caught. I think they kind of learned their lesson quite badly. That actually they weren't as careful or as hidden as they thought they were, and I think it's really caused now a lot of problems for the companies since our investigation. At one point, the company was being estimated valued at $1.5 billion, and then I heard last year that the owner of the company, who is a private equity firm, they basically said it's valueless and tried to almost want to write off the debt. So I think that shows that actually there is some potential for civil society working together to try and really highlight this problem and cause some consequences for people who are enabling these human rights abuses. Unfortunately, the problem isn't over. NSO is still around. We're still tracking them. There's also a dozen other companies in Germany, in Austria, also in many in Israel, who are trying to develop and sell these types of tools. So it's still an ongoing battle to try and make sure that this problem is properly controlled, and we don't just stop with seeing one company like NSO who's been exposed for this. And just on the last point, I was interested to see that another surveillance company that we're monitoring are now hiring roles for what they call an operational security engineer, which I think is to make sure they don't have the NSO problem of getting all of their software burned and exposed.
I mean, on the other hand, it's also a difficult problem for people who are security engineers and like to hack. So how to choose your job? How can you be sure you're on the right side? I mean, Okay, Amnesty International, but I don't know how many job offers are there with similar ethical standard to say so. All right, so it looks like, didn't count, but it looks like we have attendance record today, so I want to give you also the chance to to ask questions. But first, to make it more private for us, let's say bye to the stream audience. Almost. Quickly want to announce the next rounds of Netzpolitische Abend. So it's now pretty much monthly. I think mostly the third Thursday of the month. Next will be April 20. So if you're new to Digitale Gesellschaft, or maybe I do this in German, it's a bit simpler since the slide is in German. Also, wenn ihr neu in Kontakt seid mit der Digitalen Gesellschaft, würde es uns wahnsinnig freuen, ihr würdet mit uns in Kontakt bleiben. Es gibt ganz viele Möglichkeiten. Die Homepage ist natürlich immer ein guter Anlaufsort. Wir haben einen Newsletter, der monatlich versendet wird. Der QR-Code bringt euch direkt zur Anmeldung für den Newsletter. Wir haben einen Podcast, es gibt weitere Treffen, zum Beispiel Mittagessen in fast allen größeren Schweizer Städten. Wir sind auch auf den mehr oder weniger bösen Social-Media-Kanälen verfügbar, von Mastodon bis Instagram ist alles mit dabei. Und wenn euch das noch immer nicht genug Engagement ist, dann haben wir noch die, weiß nicht, sagt man Unterseite, die heißt Ich mache mit. Hier könnt ihr mitmachen, ihr könnt jetzt das Formular, um Mitglied zu werden oder auch einfach eine Spende zu hinterlassen. In diesem Sinne danke ich euch allen fürs Herkommen, fürs Zuschauen und Donaka danke ich herzlich fürs Kommen und ja, ich glaube, er hat einen Applaus verdient, oder?
Haben wir noch some questions?
So...